Testing, 1, 2, 3. Hi, my name's Ilanka. I'm going to be speaking on famous unsolved codes. And my fan club is in the front two rows. That's a little too much volume. I'll just go ahead and start talking. And yeah, okay. So I spoke a little bit about a few codes yesterday when I gave a talk about the Knights Templar, and there were a couple questions there about some codes that were very loosely Templar related, so I'm going to be folding those into this talk as well. I'm going to be talking about some of the world's most famous unsolved codes and a little bit about how I got involved with cryptography. Then I'm going to go into one of my favorite subjects, which is about Kryptos, the encrypted sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters. This was actually on an episode of Nova Science Now, the PBS program, about a week and a half ago or so. So I'm going to actually show that clip here. It's about an 11-minute video. So I'll probably do that about halfway through this talk, and then I'll show the Nova video, and then I'll talk more about what we saw in the Nova video, and then we'll have questions and answers and anything that anybody wants to talk about. So my day job is that I'm a game designer. I've been working in the online multiplayer game industry since about 1990, and I actually got involved with cryptography through DragonCon. I was here giving a talk on games, and I was coming to the hacking panels, just kind of sitting in the back rows there listening to the hackers talk. And through them, I heard about this code that had been released as part of a hacker convention called Freaknik in Nashville, Tennessee. And it was a code that had been released for the people at the convention to solve, but no one had solved it. It had been a year, and still no one had cracked it. So I kind of picked up the flyers with all the other stuff that you see kind of sitting around on the tables at DragonCon. And I took the code home, and then I was really bored one weekend. I think I was homesick with the flu or something, and I took a look at the code, and I just got totally obsessed with it, and I couldn't put it down. And I completely blocked out the rest of my life. I did nothing but work on this code, but I cracked it. And I won the prize, which was a free trip to HackerCon, the next con, so free hotel, free drinks and T-shirts. Not that it's hard to get free drinks at a HackerCon. And then I went and I cracked a bunch of other codes. And I actually cracked so many codes that I've actually been banned from competition in the HackerCon. So for example, at AtlantaCon, when they released their code and it was on a sheet of paper on the flyer, at the bottom of the flyer it said, "Note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantaCon code. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka." So of course I cracked that one too. And then I got more involved with codes, and through these codes I heard about other more famous codes, such as Kryptos. And also around that time is when September 11th happened in 2001. And I was wondering if maybe I could, I was as enraged as everyone else by what happened on September 11th, and I was wondering if I could use my cryptography skills to kind of help out with the war on terrorism. So I called the local FBI in St. Louis where I live, and I said, "Hey, can I help?" And they said no. And so then I called back the next week, and "Can I help?" And they said no. And I kept calling back, and finally I got a hold of an agent who kind of asked, "Well, what is it that you know about?" And I told him about the different kinds of cryptography that I'd been playing with, and he said, "You know, there's a kind of code that we think that Al-Qaeda may be using, and it's called steganography. And steganography is a way of hiding messages inside of pictures on the internet." And he said, "You know, there's probably big brains in Washington, D.C. that know all about this code stuff, but we're here in St. Louis, and you know, cryptography isn't really our mission here. So maybe you could kind of come to one of our meetings and kind of give a talk about what steganography is." And so I think they thought I was going to come in and give a little, you know, 5-minute talk, but I put together this full PowerPoint presentation with about 70 slides about what steganography was and how I don't think that Al-Qaeda was using it, but I went through about where the rumors came from that Al-Qaeda might be using it. And I also talked about what kind of codes that Al-Qaeda was using at the time, which were fairly simplistic codes. For example, if they were talking on the phone and they wanted to say FBI, instead of saying FBI, they might say food and beverage industry. So they would just kind of disguise the acronyms a little bit. So I went and I gave that talk, and the talk was a big hit. And there were representatives there from the FBI and from the Secret Service and postal inspectors and customs agents. And then I started getting invited to a bunch of other places to give talks. And so I started, and people were asking me questions at these talks, and so I would try to answer the questions. If I didn't know the answers, I'd go research them. And then I got so many questions, I started making a website about them. things just took off from there. And then I found people were asking me, well, how famous is this code? How famous is that code? And I would say, well, okay, and I made a list of Ilanka's list of the world's most famous unsolved codes. And then that started becoming a favorite in the blogosphere, and everybody was linking to it. And then a publisher from England contacted me and said, would you like to write a book about codes? And I said, no. And and then he kept calling me back and saying, well, maybe you can just do a few puzzles, and maybe do a few more, and all of a sudden I have a book on the Mammoth Book of Secret Codes and Cryptograms, which, get ready for the applause, is now in its fourth printing. Thank you very much. So, and thank Dragon Con for all of it. So, let me continue on here. So I'll talk a little, just very briefly, about the Freaknik code and some of the other, there were other things. You can go on the web and you can find out more about this stuff. I did with September 11th, and I uncovered a hoax, someone who faked, he used September 11th as an opportunity to fake his own death as a way of getting sympathy on the internet. It was a really scummy thing to do, but I was the one that figured that one out. The Cyrillic projector is an encrypted sculpture that was created by the same sculptor, James Sanborn, who created the crypto sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters. And it had been a sculpture sitting in the middle of the university in North Carolina in Charlotte for about 10 years, and no one had cracked it. And so I put together a team, and we cracked it. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that was done. And let's see. So this is the Freaknik code. This is the flyer, the flyer that I picked up here at DragonCon back in DragonCon 2000. I picked this up, and I won't go into the details of how it's put together, but it's basically an onion. You have to solve one set of codes, and you solve another set of codes, and it actually goes through several different kinds of encryption, substitution ciphers. There's some transposition. There's some secret puzzles. There's even a PGP message buried in there. So you have to, not that I could crack PGP just by, you know, pumping it through a text editor, but there was a PGP key hidden in a different website, and I had to track that down. And then after I cracked the code, I went and I wrote this whole tutorial about how I'd done it. And I wrote it in a very tongue-in-cheek kind of cyberpunk fashion. So if you enjoy kind of these treasure hunts, it's kind of a fun read. It's a little bit dated at this point, especially because I was linking to all these neat tools like, hey, have you ever heard of this thing called Search Engine? And I would link there. And now Google was just starting right about the time I wrote this tutorial. So some of the links have succumbed to web rot. But there's still a lot of fun things in there, and there's lots of little in-jokes. I don't even think all of them have been found at this point. I have references to everything, The Matrix and Monty Python and Illuminatus Trilogy. There's all kinds of stuff in there. So this is the CIA's crypto sculpture, and I'll talk much more about this later. It's about 12 feet tall, about 20 feet long, and it's in the center of CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. So there's four metal plates there, and there's letters that are carved through it. It's actually transparent, so you can see through it to the trees on the other side. And there's four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved yet, and it's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. This is my list, and I put cryptos at about number five. It might be a little bit higher at this point because of the Nova segments. I haven't looked at that recently. And this is the web page that I made on famous unsolved codes. You can go to Ilanka.com, E-L-O-N-K-A, and if you just go to Ilanka.com, you can find links to all this. So this is one of the questions that I got yesterday when I was talking about the Knights Templar, and someone was asking about this. Is the woman who asked the question here, by the way? Oh, darn. Okay, I'll go into it anyway. So when I was talking about the fact and fiction of the Knights Templar and how there are many mysteries that are associated with them that aren't really associated with the Templars, but they are there. And this one does have a code involved with it. And off the coast of Nova Scotia, in northeastern North America, there's this tiny little island called Oak Island. And in about 1795, some teenagers were playing there, and they found a tree, and next to the tree there was this kind of indentation in the ground. And they said that there was a branch over the indentation with like a, you know, kind of the tackle thing, like there was a pulley with a rope. And they went back later and they started digging, and about 10 feet down they found a platform of logs. And they kept digging, and then they found another platform, and they kept digging, and they found another platform. And they went down, I'd say, about 40 or 50 feet, and it just kept going and going and going. And they were wondering what was down there, but they just didn't have the facilities to dig really any deeper than that. And over the last couple hundred years, a lot of people have been going back there to dig. And there's been many articles that have been written on it. This is one of the diagrams. It's called Oak Island. And so again, here was the tree, and there was the branch, and then they just started digging, and they kept finding more platforms. And according to some reports from the from the early 1800s, a stone was found right about here that had an encrypted message on it. And the encrypted message was a basic substitution cipher that said, 40 feet below, 2 million pounds lie buried. And of course, that got a lot of attention in the newspapers, the idea of a big buried treasure there. So there's been major drilling, 1849, 61, 87. Several people have died going down there because it's an island and it's very close to sea level. And if you dig down too deep, the water starts pouring in. And at this point, the island is no longer a nice wooded island. It's basically like a strip mined area because they've had so much digging down there, and they've basically removed like all the earth down to a level of a couple hundred feet. And yet people keep digging. So it's a big mystery. Was there something there? My guess is that the stone was faked. My guess is that somebody was digging and they needed financing to continue digging, and they were having trouble convincing their investors to go any deeper, and so they came up with this encrypted stone that hinted that there was a treasure much deeper down. Other people have done this as well to kind of trick the investors to give them more money. The latest status that I heard, there were some legal battles about who owned the island in the 1990s, and last I heard was in 2005 there was a new partnership that had bought the rights to it, and they were debating what they were going to do with it. Keep digging, or maybe they'll turn it into a tourist attraction, I don't know. If you want more information, the criticalenquiry.org has a fantastic site, very, very detailed about Oak Island. There's also a good blog spot at Oak Island Treasure News Archives.blogspot.com. And the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute did a very comprehensive report about it. Yes, there was a question.
Could the 2 million pounds, how much has it cost to
dig that? I think that they have spent way more than 2 million pounds already just trying to dig down there. The nickname for the place is the Money Pit. It's the Money Pit. And I don't think there was 2 million pounds. Maybe there was one chest of something down there, or maybe it was just a natural sinkhole. There are other natural sinkholes that are in that area geographically. And so you'll see land, and then there'll be this kind of indentation where it'll sort of look like someone was digging, or maybe there was a hole that kind of settled. And so when these people were saying that they found platforms, what they may have just found is that it was a sinkhole, that you know some wood fell in there at one point, and so they dug down 10 feet, and they found maybe a log. And then they kind of spun the story, you know, like fishing, you know, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger as you tell the story. And so I think that it's just a lot of other stories that have piled on. Was there a question way in the back?
Yeah, I had a question about that. And that was apparently the logs don't exist any longer. So they shouldn't be carbon dated or anything like that.
The question was whether the logs still exist. Could they be carbon dated? I don't think much exists at all. In fact, this cipher stone, the encrypted stone, mysteriously disappeared in 1912. There's very, very little. Just lots and lots of stories. So here's a code that's a real code. This was the Dorabella cipher. This was written in 1897 by Edward Elgar. He was famous for composing the pomp and circumstance music that you hear if you ever go to a graduation, you know, da 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 da. Yeah. Well, he was also into codes, and one of the pieces of music that he composed was called the Enigma Variations, which was a series of different musical pieces, and each piece was associated with one of his friends, like maybe a musical laugh of a person. And so it was sort of a puzzle to figure out which piece went with which friend. And one of them was Miss Dora Penny, a young woman, 22 years old, and she was a good friend, and they would go for long walks, and they went to various these social gatherings. And at one point, he sent her a message. It was a message, I think it was written on the back of an envelope that was sent to, I think, her mother. You know, please pass this message along to Miss Dora Penny. And it seems like a simple code. It seems like a simple substitution cipher, but no one's ever been able to solve it. And in her biography, much later in her life, she said, if anyone could solve it, I would most appreciate if you could tell me what it says. She contacted him once and asked him what it said. And he said, I'm surprised of all the things that we've talked about that you couldn't read it. So, we don't know. You'll hear me say that a lot. We don't know. That's why they're famous unsolved codes. Okay. Zodiac ciphers. This was a serial killer who was active in California in the late 1960s. And he would taunt the media, and he would send them encrypted messages saying, if you can solve this message, it says who I am and how you can find me. And there were several messages, over 20 of them. The first couple were solved, and they say pretty gruesome things. You know, I like killing people. But it doesn't say anything about who he is or how he could be found. And the case was never solved. There was actually a movie on it recently. I haven't seen the movie.
It's creepy.
Do they talk about the messages in the movie, and do they solve them in the movie?
No. Someone goes nutty trying to.
That's very believable. I can empathize with that. So anyone who wants more information on these, again, a very good website called ZodiacKiller.com that has pictures of all of these messages if you'd like to try your hand at it. Then there's the Beale Papers. This is a fun one. This is a pamphlet that was published in the late 1800s. And in the pamphlet, it talks about the authentic statements regarding the treasure buried in 1819 and 1821 near Buford's in Bedford County, Virginia, and which has never been recovered. Price, 50 cents. So my belief is that the pamphlet was written as a way of raising money. But it's an interesting story. According to the pamphlet, and this is the only verification that we have about the story, is from this one pamphlet. There's no other verification. But according to the pamphlet, a man arrived in Bedford County, Virginia, with three large wagons full of gold and gems, which he then buried at some location near Buford's. And he left the town, and before he left a small box with a local innkeeper, and with instructions to the innkeeper that if the man did not return, then the innkeeper was to open the box and follow the instructions that were inside the box. The man never returned. The innkeeper opened the box, and he found some encrypted messages. He didn't know what to do with them. He passed them along to a younger friend. The younger friend spent some time with the encrypted messages and solved one of them. That one message talked about how there was gold and gems that were buried near Buford's. The young friend continued to work on the other two messages, could never solve them, and then decided that he was done with it. He was tired of spending so much time on it and decided to publish everything he knew about the story, including the three encrypted messages and the answer to one of them, in this one pamphlet, and saying, I'm washing my hands of it. I want nothing more to do with this. So the pamphlet sold quite well. And there was three ciphers, three papers, 1, 2, and 3. This is paper number 2, and it's a series of numbers, 115, 73, 24, 807, 37. And the decryption of it, it was decrypted with the Declaration of Independence. So if you take the Declaration of Independence, you know, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and you number each one of those words. So when is one, in is two. So you go to the paper number 2, which is 115, and you find the 115th word, which is instituted, and you take the first letter of that word, which is I. And you take the 73, which is the 73rd word, hold, and you take the first letter, which is H, 24, another, A, and you keep going. So you I-H-A-V-E, I have. And you keep going through all the numbers using the Declaration of Independence, and you get a complete message, which I won't read the whole thing, but it basically says, I have deposited about 4 miles from Buford's a vault under the ground that has 1,014 pounds of gold, 3,812 pounds of silver, and you know, it talks about how they're in pots with lids, or iron pots with iron covers. And paper number 1 describes the exact location of the vault, and then paper number 3 describes to whom this treasure belongs. So this is paper number 1, which is also a series of numbers. Supposedly this has the locality of the vault. The numbers here are different. Some of them go much larger. The numbers are larger than the number of words, I believe, that actually exist in the Declaration of Independence. And no one's been able to solve this at all. They've tried it with the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, various plays and correspondence and books. Nothing's come up. Paper number 3, same type of cipher system, appears to be a book cipher of some sort. Supposedly it's the names and residences of the people who own the treasure. And again, nothing has been able to be solved. So, is there a real treasure there, or is this a hoax? There's been a lot of analysis on it. My belief is that it's a hoax. There's inconsistencies in the language. For example, when they're talking about the story about how the gold was found, they use the word stampede. Well, the word stampede really didn't come into common usage until the late 1800s. So when they're talking about correspondence from the early 1800s, it doesn't quite jibe. Also, just the whole idea, they found this gold, I think, off in New Mexico or something, and then they transported 3 wagons full of gold all the way back to Virginia to bury it. Why do that? There's plenty of other large cities along the way. You're going through St. Louis, you're going through other areas where there are banks and there are better places to put gold than to bury them near an inn somewhere in Virginia. Also, Jim Gologli, who's a very famous cryptographer, he was actually the first person to publicly crack the first parts of cryptos. He ran some interesting analysis on it with the Declaration of Independence, and he found that there were some patterns in the letters that made it look like a hoax. For example, when he ran it with that document, Declaration of Independence, he didn't find any words, but he found A, B, C, D, E, F, G. He found the alphabet, more or less, in order. And it was, why would that be? You know, it's not the kind of thing that randomly would show up. And what it tells me is that someone was faking the paper, and they were trying to come up with numbers, and they were getting really bored. And so they decided to do the alphabet at one point as they were faking all these other numbers. Now, other people have said, no, that doesn't mean that it's debunked. It means that maybe you're on the right track if you find the alphabet. Maybe it's an onion, and you've solved one part of the code, and now you need to solve the next part of the code. But So, also the main thing is that there just aren't any other independent sources of information. Just this one pamphlet. There's no other, you know, hotel receipts, anything indicating that there were 3 wagons, you know, passing through any other areas. There's just that one pamphlet. So, just as today on the internet, we have people who will make things up and send them out in email. They make up urban legends about, you know, hypodermics and gas pump handles and other things. And I think that this was an 1885 urban legend. I think that someone was just goofing around. It was a very clever goofing around, but I believe it's a hoax. Also, it's possible that it was associated with the local Freemason organization as a way of getting people to think about things. Masons are often involved with the search for information, and they say that the search is more important than what you actually find. And there was an Aesop's fable about the farmer and his sons. And very briefly, what this was is that a farmer was dying, and he was worried that his family would not prosper because they would not take care of the farm and they wouldn't take care of the vineyards. So before he died, he told his sons that there was a great treasure buried out there in the vineyard. And after he died, his sons were always out in the fields digging for this treasure. They never found anything, but because they were digging, the crops prospered and the family prospered. So it was the search. It was that idea that there might be something that kept the motivation up so that people would continue looking. All right, I see a question in the back.
How much would it cost at that time frame to actually publish the pamphlet for which he was charging 50 cents?
Good question. How much would it cost to actually publish the pamphlet? I'm guessing considerably less than 50 cents, considering the amount of inflation since then, but I couldn't tell you exactly. He may have also been associated with a printer. I seem to remember something about a local printer being involved with it, but sorry, I couldn't tell you the exact answer.
Okay. David Baldacci's written.
David Baldacci has written a story about the Beale ciphers. Okay, I'll have to go. Is it good? Okay. I see another question there.
When you're doing stuff like that, like, you know, they decode it with, like, the Declaration of Independence, do they just start picking random documents out of thin air and just see if it works?
Basically, yeah. A lot of codes. So the question is, when you're testing something with a book cipher and you're trying to find out which document, such as the Declaration of Independence, how do you know which document to choose? And a lot of code solving is just trial and error. You try this, does that work? No. Did you try this? Is it substitution? You can do frequency analysis. You can make a guess. If I were to see a series of numbers, the things that I would do is I would look at it and I would see, okay, first I would look at what's the smallest number, what's the largest number, and that would give me a sense, you know, maybe I'm looking at a large document or a small document. I would also do what's called a frequency analysis, and I would look to see if any of the numbers repeated. For example, if the number 17 appeared a whole lot, then there's a chance that that might be an E, because an E is the most commonly used letter in the English alphabet. And so I might try and analyze the vowels, and then if I could maybe get a few words like the here and there, and then I might kind of get it, maybe get some hints at it that way. But solving a code is often very It's guesswork. Sometimes with these kind of book ciphers, there's a prearranged system. Someone will say, maybe someone in prison is sending letters back to someone at home, and they're putting secret messages in those letters. And they might have said, okay, I'm taking a copy of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass or something. And so the first letter I send you will be based on book cipher on page 5, and the second letter will be page 10 and 15. That way the wardens who are reading it won't see anything. I mean, if they see numbers, they're going to freak out. But there might be some other way of hiding the numbers inside the page, pinpricks or letters or grids. There's just an infinite number of code systems out there. So if you prearrange with someone and they know what document to expect. So it's possible that those book ciphers were connected to a document, but maybe the document was a handwritten letter that no longer exists. Maybe it was a draft of a play that no longer exists, or maybe it does exist and we just haven't tried it. Okay. So next code, Voynich manuscript. This is a document of hundreds of pages that has this really elaborate script on it that is unlike any language that exists and has no one's been able to solve. There are also drawings of plants, and the plants are unlike things that exist. It's at least 400 years old, a couple hundred pages long, not recognized by language, not by grammar, not by cipher, not by letters, nothing. It's a big mystery. It's so elaborately done, and with all these drawings, and it was purchased by Emperor Rudolf in the 16th century, and he paid big ducats for it, 600 gold ducats. That was about $30,000 at the time. So if it's a hoax, it was a very, very elaborate hoax. But it may have been done as a hoax, because people knew that Emperor Rudolf enjoyed buying things that were curious. And so I think somebody gave him exactly what it was that he was asking for, something kind of odd, something that would something that was a big mystery. So it kind of disappeared for a couple hundred years and then was rediscovered in the early 1900s by a book dealer. That was Voynich. That's why it's called the Voynich manuscript. But it has been verified that it existed quite a while back. There was an article in the Scientific American a couple years ago about someone said that he may have figured out the way that it was created for the hoax with a card and grill system, meaning that there were these large grids, and then maybe somebody moved this card with holes over it and then came up with it, and that's why it sort of seems to have an internal structure in it. My favorite theory is that maybe somebody used dice, like if you had 20-sided dice and you put a different symbol on each side and then you rolled the dice and came up with the word. I believe that it's random. That's my belief. Okay, next cipher, Edgar Allan Poe, challenge ciphers. Allan Poe, along with writing The Raven and other things, was also a big fan of cryptography and codes. And he wrote a regular column, and he actually put out a challenge to his readers saying if they sent him any cipher that was a single alphabet cipher, what we call a mono-alphabetic substitution cipher, that he would crack it. And as a cryptographer, I can say mono-alphabetic ciphers are the easiest cipher in the world to crack. I mean, if you have enough, you can crack it pretty quick. But most people, they would send him things, and he'd crack it, and they'd go, wow, you're really amazing. And he would keep doing this regularly. As he was signing off the column, he said, and here, dear readers, are two more ciphers for you. And he posted these challenge ciphers, which supposedly were sent to him by M. Tyler in 1839. And no one cracked these until 1992. Finally, the first one was cracked, and then the second one was cracked in 2000. So this is one of them, and you can see, I don't know if you can see it from the back, but it looks like it was on a typewriter where things were lowercase and uppercase, and then some of the letters are upside down. And it was a very interesting kind of code. I think it was sort of I think it came out to be like a homophonic code, where it was multiple alphabets. And it came out to be, actually that's not the answer. Here was the answer. It was a polyalphabetic substitution cipher. And I believe this was a quote from a play. It was early spring, warm and sultry glowed the afternoon. And then the other cipher was again symbols that looked like you got from a typewriter. Now this one was actually, it turned out to be a monoalphabetic substitution cipher. For example, if you can see here, there's a comma and then the cross and then the section symbol, and over here the comma and the cross and the section symbol and the comma and the cross and the section symbol. So as I was talking about, if I was looking at this today and I would look, okay, there's a grouping of three letters that seem to be appearing over and over, and what's the most commonly used word in the English language? the, right? So if you say, okay, that's probably a T, that's an H, that's an E, and that's exactly how it came apart. You know, the soul, secure in her existence, smiles at the drawn dagger and defies its point. So you can go to Bokler.com and you can get more information about this. B-O-K-L-E-R. Okay, here's the Phaistos disc. This is considerably older. This is the oldest thing that I'm going through. This is a disc. It's about 6 inches across. It was discovered near Greece. And we're seeing two sides of it. And these symbols were stamped into it. They weren't done individually. Somebody had a stamp, and they went through in this spiral pattern, and several of the symbols repeat. We have no clue what it says. It was found near some tablets that used a system called Linear A and Linear B. I believe Linear B has been solved. Linear A has not. Maybe we'll solve it, maybe we won't. Often this is thousands of years old. So often to solve these, we need to have some idea of the phonetics of the spoken language at that time. And with really old languages, the language is gone. We no longer have it. Maybe it'll turn out to be a Rosetta Stone for something, or maybe there'll be some other link. We found nothing else that has these symbols. It's just this one disc with these symbols. And that also makes something very difficult to solve. It's not like in India, in the Indus Valley, there are these symbols where there's just thousands and thousands of symbols on all sorts of different objects, on stones and on spears and on other things. We don't know what it says, but we have lots and lots of these symbols to work from. But it still hasn't been solved. With this thing, we only have this one disc. So it's believed to date back to 1800 BC. 45 different symbols. And there's 241 signs stamped on it on both sides. Kryptos. Okay, here's where we get the video, if I can get this to work.
Did anyone crack your code yet?
That code, yes. And we actually just aired the show again a couple weeks ago, and we put a new code in that, which is hard. Okay, let's go. So, Kryptos. These are rubbings that I made of the sculpture when I was there. I visited when I was giving my talks about Al-Qaeda codes. I was actually invited to CIA headquarters to give the talk. And I said I would come speak. I didn't want to be paid, but I did want time to actually sit and look at the sculpture for a while. So it's a long story. Buy me a drink, I'll tell you the long story. But I did get into CIA, and I did get these rubbings. Each one of these is done on a standard 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So that can also kind of give you an idea of the scale of the characters. Part 4, this is the part that has not been solved yet. We say 97 or 98 characters, and the reason we say that is because of that question mark at the very beginning of it. We don't know for sure if the question mark is the end of Part 3 or the beginning of Part 4. Part 3 does end with a question mark. Can you see anything? So we just say 97 or 98 characters. James Sanborn, I've met him several times. I've taken him out drinking. I've pumped him for all the information I can. He's about the same as you saw him on the program. He was born in 1945 in Washington, D.C. His father worked for the Library of Congress, was the director of exhibitions there. And that's how Sanborn got some of these other encrypted documents that he has, because his father had access to them in the Library of Congress. And this is Jim Galogli, as you saw in the Nova segment, who's also solved several other codes. And when I was researching Kryptos, I found out that after I was making a list of everything that Sanborn had ever done, because when I was researching Sanborn, I called his agent and I said, can you send me a list of everything Sanborn's ever done? And the agent said, no, it would be too hard to make such a list. No one could possibly make such a list. So I said, okay, I'll make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. And so I started compiling this website, and it was after that Sanborn first contacted me. He said, who are you and why do you have a website about me? And so then I started talking to him, and he said, oh, okay, and he realized that it was kind of good marketing to have the list out there on the web. And And as I was gathering information about the sculptures, what I found is that after he made Kryptos at CIA headquarters, he made this other piece, which is called the Untitled Kryptos piece, which was sold to a private collector. And I tracked down the current location of it. It went through various hands, but is currently in the home of a dot-com millionaire in Los Angeles. And I called up the dot-com millionaire, and I said, "Hi, I'm Ilonka. Can I come in and see your garden?" And he said, "Sure." And I was able to go in there and take some pictures. These particular pictures were taken by Jim Galogli, but I was able to visit in person. And what this piece has is it has all of the text of Kryptos on one side, and on the other side it's all a bunch of encrypted Russian text. And so you can see on one side here, this is the Kryptos side. And actually, the order is slightly different than it is on Kryptos. So on Kryptos, if the parts go 1, 2, 3, 4, on the Untitled Kryptos piece, they go 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it repeats. And then it kind of chops off halfway through one of the pieces. Also, on this other side, this encrypted Russian text was on another sculpture of Sanborn's, which was called the Cyrillic Projector. And this is the one that's at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte that was installed there in the early 1990s and hadn't been cracked for a long time. And then I put together a team. And some of the people in our Kryptos Yahoo group worked on solving it, and some people who helped out weren't even involved with the Yahoo group. We kind of found each other by accident. So the difference between the Untitled piece and Kryptos is the Cyrillic Projector only has about three-quarters of what you saw on the Untitled piece. There's a larger version of the Untitled piece, which is called Antipodes. Antipodes is what's at the Hirshhorn Museum. That's what you saw in the Nova segment. And so the the Russian side, and then on the English side, like I said, we have what's on Kryptos. Also, another difference, and they didn't get this quite right in the Nova segment, but the Untitled version has two extra dots. So this is the Untitled version, and you can see it starts with what we call the Endy line, E-N-D-Y-A-H-R. And about two-thirds of the way down, right around here, there are these two dots. These two dots exist only on the Antipodes Untitled pieces. They do not exist on the Kryptos sculpture at CIA headquarters. We don't know why the dots are here and not on the Kryptos piece. Maybe it's a clue, maybe it's not. We don't know. If they were on the Kryptos piece, they would be right around here. Okay. So now the way that the Kryptos is together, we have four panels. Two of the panels have the actual code ciphertext. The other two panels have what's called the cipher alphabet. The cipher alphabet is the same 26 letters in the alphabet, just slightly rearranged. You take a keyword, such as in this case the word Kryptos, you move those letters to the front of the alphabet, you pile everything up behind, and so you still end up with 26 letters, just in a different arrangement. And then you can take that cipher alphabet with the keyword of Kryptos, and you can make a grid. So on each line, you shift things over by one. So you get these nice diagonals that are going. And you also see this way, you can see the word Kryptos at the top line, and you can also read Kryptos vertically here. So you're using the same key for both. Now to make this harder, use different keys. So you have one key to make the cipher alphabet, and then you spell a different word coming down the left margin. In this case, we're going to make the grid here, and we're going to use a second keyword, which is the word palimpsest. And so you see each line is being shifted according to the letter in that word palimpsest. And so this makes a grid that's much more complex. And then you can use this grid to use in cipherment and decipherment. Palimpsest, by the way, is a word that means a scroll that had a message written on it, and then that message was scraped off, and then another message was written onto the scroll afterwards. So when you're looking at the new message, you see not only the new message, but you can also see bits and pieces of the old message showing through. And the word palimpsest can be used not just for scrolls, but it's also used in other contexts. For example, someone might say that the city of Rome in Italy is a palimpsest, because you can be standing on a street corner today and you can see modern buildings, you can also see medieval buildings, you can also see the Roman architecture as well. So you're seeing all the different layers at one time. So Kryptos part one is the top two lines on the ciphertext side, where it starts Emufphus, E-M-U-F-P-H-Z. So again, we have our grid with Kryptos and palimpsest, and you take that ciphertext, Emufphus, E-M-U-F-P-H-Z, and you put each letter on a different line, E-M-U-F-P. So you go the E, and you trace up, and it becomes a B. An M becomes an E, a U becomes a T, and you go on. So E-M-U-F-P-H-Z becomes B-E-T-W-E-E-N, between. Okay? And you keep doing that, and you can decipher the entire thing. It's called a polyalphabetic system. So this is the ciphertext using the keywords of Kryptos and palimpsest, You get between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. Now it says there's Q, occlusion. Why is that Q there? It's actually hard-coded into the sculpture. And I talked to James Sanborn, and I said, why is that Q there? And there's another typo later in the sculpture. And I said, is that just a mistake? And he said, no, it's deliberate. But it's not what it is that's so important, it's where it is. It's the orientation or the positioning. Don't know what that means? That's what he said. Okay, part two starts here on the third line, goes all the way down to the bottom of this plate. Here's the ciphertext for it. Now, Sanborn actually made an announcement a couple years ago where we thought we knew the answer to part two, and he said no, there was actually a difference because he'd actually taken a letter out of the sculpture for some reason. And he called me up on the phone and said, oops, I left a letter out. So he said there was actually supposed to be he didn't tell me it was supposed to be an S there. He just said something was wrong. And we went and figured out what we thought the mistake might have been, and I went back to him and I said, did you mean for it to say this? And he said, yeah. And then we worked backwards and said, oh, so you meant to put an S there? And he said, oh, yeah, I guess so. So the plain text with this was cryptos, and instead of cryptos and palimpsest, we had cryptos and abscissa. Abscissa is a mathematical term. It means the x-coordinate on a graph. So, and it came out to say it was totally invisible. How is that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground, and here's another typo where underground was misspelled, to an unknown location, X. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere, X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose. And when Sanborn was actually going in and looking at things, ID by Rose, when he'd first heard ID by Rose, he thought that we weren't saying the ciphertext, he thought we were saying the method that we had used to solve the system. And he said, no, that's not part of the answer. And so we went, and it's not, what is it supposed to say? So we went and looked at it, and we said, okay, is it supposed to say instead X layer 2? And he said, yes, that is the correct answer. And the reason that it's so different is because it's this polyalphabetic system, when you're deciphering a letter, it depends not only what the letter is, but where it is. So if you even shift something left or right, as happened when he took a letter out of the sculpture, it changed everything that much. So part three starts here at the top of this plate and goes down to about here. And you also see there's a few letters that are sort of out of alignment. And I showed Sanborn my slides at one point, and when I showed him the slide, he pointed at those letters and he said, has anyone figured these out? They're important. And I'm like, and I threw a bunch of ideas at him, and he just smiled and sat back. And so we've had all kinds of theories about what they mean, and we don't know for sure, and he's never confirmed anything one way or the other. So here's the ND line, the NDR line. So on the untitled piece, this is the first line on the untitled piece. On Cryptos, it's the beginning of part three. And as you look at this, some people will notice that the composition of the letters here is different than on the others, because here there are some letters that are more common. The first two, it was a more homogeneous kind of all the letters in the alphabet, whereas here there are certain letters that are more common. Does everybody kind of see that we see more E's, more T's? So this is a different system. This is actually English here. All of the letters in the message are here. They're just rearranged, and we need to figure out the method of how to dearrange them. So this is a method that I came up with and that I published early on, which is that Gologly was the first one to do it. He did it with a computer, and I came up with a pencil and paper method of doing it. So what I did is I put all of the letters into these rows, and then starting here on the far right, started with the S, and then I counted down 1, 2, 3, 4 to an L, 1, 2, 3, 4 to an O, 1, 2, 3, 4 W. So S, L, O, W, slow, slowly, desperately, slowly. And if you do that, you keep going that way, you get these lovely diagonals, and you get the message coming out. And here's another, by the way, another mistake. I believe that this one was just an actual spelling error. I think that Sanborn forgot how to spell the word desperately. Okay. And as I've been working on other codes, I found that there are typos that go into codes, and that's how I've cracked some of the codes, like in the hacker scene, in the Freaknik code, in the Atlanticon code, there were mistakes in them. And that's why someone couldn't just push them into a computer and decipher them, because if someone was encrypting it with pencil and paper, and they're probably doing this the night before the con, and they're probably a little bit drunk while they're doing it. And so as I'm looking at the cipher, and I'm thinking, it's not coming apart, but wait a minute, somebody did this by hand, they were probably tired, they were probably drunk, what method were they using and what mistakes would they have made? And then I go, okay, well, maybe instead of shifting left, he shifted right, and oh, there's a word. And then I go through and he got this part right, he got this part wrong, and the entire thing kind of zips out that way. And so it's something to be aware of for anyone who's solving a code, is don't assume that the code creator was perfect. Even typing a letter, an unencrypted letter, like just typing normal business correspondence in English, look at how often you see typos in it. People misspell words, they put punctuation in the wrong places. With codes, it gets that much harder because you can't see the error. So part three, the answer came out to be, slowly, desperately slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. So again, we have the question at the end of it, which is why we don't know if the question mark is at the end of part three or the beginning of part four. So as they said in the Nova segment, this is from Howard Carter's diary on November 26, 1922. His answer to the question of can you see anything was yes, wonderful things, or it is wonderful. And we thought, well, maybe that's like a crib. Maybe that's something that's going to help us solve part four. And we've been playing with that a little bit. This part four, can't tell you what it says. We don't know. Nobody knows. And some people say, oh, there's got to be somebody in the government that's cracked it. And like, no, I don't think so. I've talked to plenty of people in the CIA, plenty of people in the NSA. NSA, the National Security Agency, is really the cipher agency. And the NSA, after Kryptos was created in 1990, the director of the CIA actually threw down the gauntlet to the director of the NSA, saying, you guys think you're so hot, can you solve Kryptos? And it was in 1992 that he put down this challenge. And the NSA, they put together a team, and they put the big government computers, and they sicked them on Kryptos. And they were able to solve the first three parts, and they couldn't solve the fourth part either. And so they sent a report. I've been trying to get a copy of this report. I haven't been able to get it, but they say they can send it, but they're going to have to like redact and black out certain parts of the report because they use classified technology to try and work on it. But what it came down to is that part four is very, very short. And they said if this would have happened in the field, if there was a coded message like this that went between two targets and they couldn't solve it, they would mark it as something as wait for more collection, meaning they'd want to get more messages that were done with this cipher system. And then if you had more text, then they might be able to solve it. But with something this short, it's very, very difficult to find patterns.
Have you ever asked Sanborn if he's tested it?
Have I ever asked Sanborn if he's tested it? Yes, many, many, many times. I've asked him when he was sober. I've asked him when he was drunk. I've gotten Ed Scheidt drunk as well, and I've also asked him. And the closest I found to that is I was out to dinner at the Zola Spy Restaurant next door to the International Spy Museum with Ed Scheidt and some members of the Kryptos group. And I wouldn't say I've never seen Scheidt drunk. That's not fair of me to say. But there had been some alcohol at the table. And at one point, I was really kind of pushing, and I was saying, Scheidt was kind of being hedging about, did he know the answer, did he not know the answer, and sometimes he says he does, and sometimes he says he doesn't, and then he says he used a little bit of concealment, we need to figure out the masking technique, and I was asking him, I was like, there's all these codes that have these mistakes in them. I mean, maybe Sanborn just screwed it up. How do you know that Sanborn didn't just screw it up and there's a mistake and no one's ever going to solve it? And Scheidt leaned over the table and he said, I'm sure it's done right. So that's my guess is it's been tested, but that's about the only verification I've gotten. Okay. So another reason that we may not have solved it is it's possible that there's a key that's on CIA grounds. I mean, the sculpture, I'm considered the world's number one expert on a thing. I've only seen the thing once. It's very, very difficult to get in there and look at it. And it's possible that Sanborn put a hint. Maybe there's something in the placement of the stones. Maybe there's something that's carved, hand-carved into these metal plates that we haven't been able to see. It's also possible we just missed something. We don't have, or maybe we've been misdirected in some way, like with these typos. And it's possible that he just screwed it up. It's possible that there's a mistake. So a little more about, the latitude and longitude, where do they point to? Well, they point to CIA headquarters. So this is the original headquarters building. I used to call this the old headquarters building and the new headquarters building. And then at one point I was giving this talk in Washington, D.C. at a HackerCon, and I said the old headquarters building. And from behind a pillar way at the back of the room, someone said, "We prefer original headquarters building." And I couldn't see who said it because he was behind a pillar. I'm like, okay. So the original headquarters building and the new headquarters building and this white building with the funny shaped roof here is the cafeteria. So there, you can't see them here, but there's a line of windows here by the cafeteria, so as the employees are eating, they can look out into this courtyard. Kryptos is right about here. Sanborn also made some other pieces which are out here near the front entrance to the new headquarters building. So again, here we have the cafeteria with the roof, and here's Kryptos, this little squiggle here. Sanborn designed also a duck pond. There's some stone slabs here. We think that the latitude and longitude point right about here. And we've been there, we've looked, nothing unusual. There's various manhole covers around here, so it's possible that there's something buried. Or maybe it's not that point that's important, maybe it's that point is referring, maybe you need to like make an equilateral triangle or something. The other pieces that Sanborn made are out here. There are these large slabs, this is about a foot thick, with copper sheets between the slabs. And these sheets have Morse code messages on them. They say things like SOS, shadow forces, lucid memory, T is your position. And we thought with the T is your position, that's odd. Does that mean that it says, what is your position? Does the Morse code disappear under the stone? And I asked Sanborn that, and he said yes. He said the messages go all the way underneath. And there's also a compass rose here. The compass is not aligned to true north, and the needle is not aligned to true north. So it's possible that that needle ties into things as well. So we've done some things with drawing lines. Yeah, there's Morse code, digital interpretatu. These pictures were taken by Jim Galogli, by the way, when he was able to get access to the artwork. So I told you a little bit. I already told you about these letters that are slightly out of alignment. Another thing that was pointed out to us is that on the grid side, where we have these nice diagonals of the crypto cipher alphabet, there's a difference, which is at the end of each line, you would think that it would end with the next letter in the sequence, except here there's an extra L. What it should be here is here's the extra L. It should be H-I-J-L, but instead there's an extra L here. And this line where the L is on the sculpture is the same line on the other side of the sculpture where those letters are out of alignment. So maybe it means something, maybe it doesn't. Sanborn has, we think, done other things to kind of give clues. So we've counted the number of letters on the sculpture. So the ciphertext had 867 characters, and on the tableau, 864. But then when you add in the extra L, you get 865. And then there's two spaces that are also on that tableau. So you add those, it's 867. So it's the same number of letters on either side. Maybe that's important. Maybe it's not. We don't know. We look at all this stuff. So, like I said, he may have put clues here. Now, we've solved this. We know what this says. And I have a whole other talk about how this came apart. But it was also a grid system, so you see these diagonals, and it used two keywords that were in Russian, Medusa and Tien. And the word Medusa was one of the keys. And if you look with the light on in the sculpture, you can see the word Medusa that's being projected onto the brick wall near the sculpture. Now, where does the word Medusa come from on the sculpture? It comes from the third line from the bottom. Well, you can't see it from here because of the way the projection is, but the word Medusa is there. So we look at the sculpture during the day. So again, Medusa is on this line here. And John Wilson, is John here? I think he had to go to another talk, but he's wandering around DragonCon as well. He went and he took a look at the sculpture in North Carolina. He noticed that on that third line, there was an extra bolt. And it's kind of hard to see here. You see here, and extra bolts. But if you look through the sculpture from the other side, it's really clear that there's an extra bolt. And it's the only bolt like that on the entire sculpture. So it's possible that Sanborn put that there as something to draw the eye to that line, saying that there's a hint here. That's where the key is. I've shown him this, and he's go, "Oh, yeah, well, you know, the plates were coming apart. I just kind of needed to put an extra bolt there to hold things together." Okay, so, you know, misdirection, like I said. Ed Scheidt, as you saw in the Nova segment, he's still active, still working in the Langley, Virginia area. He also likes he likes Egyptian hieroglyphics. We've talked about that. He has said he knew the last part was going to take the longest time to be cracked. He figured it would stand for at least 10 years. And he keeps talking. He said, I saved the best for last. And he talks often. Every time I go to D.C., we kind of get a group together with the Cryptos group. We take a tour through the International Spy Museum. And he kind of points out different things about cryptography. And then he'll kind of sit and he'll kind of talk about K4 and how it had a masking technique. And we need to figure out. He keeps saying the masking technique. We don't know what that means. But I figure I'll just keep telling other people and then maybe someone else will figure out what it means. I really think that it's going to be solved, but it's going to be some idea that comes out of left field. It's going to be some unorthodox thinking. So next door to the International Spy Museum is the Zola Spy Restaurant. This restaurant, the decor was actually designed by Sanborn. So there's several references to Cryptos throughout this restaurant. And also one of the parts of decor, actually, you can't see, there's a stairway behind here, and then projected on the wall is binary code, which is referring to another one of Sanborn's encrypted sculptures. But this wall, it's a classified document wall, and these are a series of documents in English and French and Russian from the various intelligence agencies corresponding back and forth and within each other during the Cold War. One of these documents has the plain text for the Cyrillic projector. When we cracked the Cyrillic projector and we figured out what it said, it was the first paragraph of one of these documents. And so that's interesting that maybe if he put the plain text for the Cyrillic projector on this wall, maybe the plain text for Cryptos is on this wall too. But we don't know. So we're trying to get close-up pictures. This is right near the waitress station. So I like go there and I take a bunch of pictures. They shoo me away and then I go back in and I take more pictures. And we're trying to get this all onto a wiki, the Alonka wiki. So, summary. There are many world-famous unsolved codes. Some of them may never be solved because I think they're probably just hoaxes. They were designed as like urban legends, as a way of getting attention. Some, I think, are solvable and have been solved, like the Edgar Allan Poe ciphers were solved after 100 years. But even with solved, many codes do have errors in them. I mean, to err is human, and it's something to keep in mind if you're ever working on one of these. Think it may have been written by someone who was not perfect. And if you want more information, we do have a Cryptos Yahoo group. Anyone who wants to come in is welcome to do so. We have about 1,000 members. And I encourage everyone, grown-ups, kids, college graduates, high school dropouts, gardeners, anybody, because I want as many different points of view coming in to look at the problem as possible. Anyone who wants is also welcome to send me a message. My website's Elonka.com. I'm also on Instant Messenger as Elonka, or just Google me. If you go to the pbs.org site, Nova, you can watch the segment that you just saw. It's freely available on their site. I also have a book, and most of the book is codes to solve, and I have a section at the end of the book about famous unsolved codes. So I have the complete text of the Beale ciphers in here. I have the text of Cryptos without about 2 months after the book was published, that's when Sanborn announced that there was a mistake in the sculpture. So there was already a mistake in the book by the time it came out. But the if you want to learn about codes, I wrote the book in what I call an airplane way, meaning that if you're on a plane and you have the book, everything you need to solve the codes is in the book. The frequency analysis charts, the glossaries, it doesn't say, okay, now log onto the web and read this or go get this dictionary here. So if you just want to solve puzzles, there's several hundred that are like the kind of things you'd see in a newspaper, and then they get harder and harder, and then, like I said, the world's most famous unsolved codes. And that's it. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, we'll start here.
You said Jim Galloway is obviously a computer guy, and he uses software.
Well, Fletch did in last month.
I assume in large part he writes.
These are some copy of
paper and that sort of thing. Do you use any software yourself, or is there anything in your paper in particular?
Okay, the question was, since I use pencil and paper, do I also use computers? And yes, I've used several different things. I find that I enjoy pencil and paper the most because it gives me a good feel for it. I've actually gotten to the point of like getting the Scrabble set and then just dumping it and kind of moving the tiles around. I freak out a lot of hackers because I say that I use Microsoft products to crack some codes. I've done some wonderful things with Microsoft Excel macros and Microsoft Word, and I like that because it's slow. As it's working on things, it's assembling the pattern in a slow motion method, and often I'll see patterns forming as it's coming in, and that'll give me an idea of something else to try. And I've written some JavaScript tools. Most often, though, there's probably already JavaScript tools that are out on the web that do most of the stuff like that. So I'll go to someone else's website and I'll say, okay, I need to do a quick RAT 13 or something like that. Okay, in the hat.
Has anyone ever just dug at Langley at those coordinates to see if there's anything under there?
Has anyone ever gone and dug a hole at Langley?
Well, by anyone, I mean the CIA, obviously.
Right, no. I hear you. I've met a few CIA agents, and I have asked them that, and they have said that there are so many. I mean, there's a lot of cameras around, and each one of them, I think, has to take like a lie detector test once a year, and they have to do all these other things. And if they were to dig, they would get fired. So they'd like to. I've tried to talk to like their public relations department and see, can I go in? And there's like a family day once a year, and so every time I meet an agent, say, can I be your long lost cousin and go in with you on family day to kind of, you know, see the site? To my knowledge, no one's done any digging. So when Sanborn, he and I were out to dinner, we were having sushi, and we were talking about what was possibly buried out there. And he was saying, you know, each day after I was installing Kryptos, they would come out with these powerful neutron scanners to scan everything I did. And I thought that was interesting, and I also thought, okay, neutron scanners. So they wrote reports on this. So I've been trying to contact, like, the landscaping office to get, or maybe Freedom of Information Act or something, to get a hold of those reports to see what was scanned. Maybe we can read the rest of the Morse code that's in there. However, when we've actually tried through Freedom of Information Act, and they write back saying documents have not been located. So either they can't, I don't think it's that they don't want to release them. My guess is that they've been destroyed at this point, or they just plain can't find them. I don't know. Okay, next, way in the back, lady in the back. Sanborn admitted to a mistake. Has he admitted to any other typos? No. he's very vague. He understands that the number one thing that gives him fame right now is Kryptos, which actually is a little bit surprising and a little bit embarrassing to him, because an artist like him tends to separate his work into two parts. They have what's called the gallery installations, and then they have what's called the public works. So the gallery installations is when he'll have something that hangs on the wall, and they have, you know, the art show where people sip the champagne and spend lots of money for the things on the walls. And that's what gives prestige to an artist. And these outdoor projects are something that artists will do as a way of kind of earning money, but they often don't get a lot of praise for it. It's kind of seen as the second class part of the art scene. And he was paid, I think, a couple $100,000 to do Kryptos. And he's done these other encrypted pieces, but it's a little bit embarrassing to him that he's so famous for one of the outdoor pieces, one of the second class pieces. He doesn't talk about it a whole lot. Okay. Next question here.
The code that was written that hasn't been solved involving from the composer?
The Elgar cipher.
I assume someone has tried overlaying musical bars on it and come up with nothing?
The question was whether people have tried to solve it with music by overlaying it with music. Several people have, and I've seen some really interesting people say they've solved it by saying they overlaid this, and they think that the actual code is a representation of a musical score of some kind, that it's music, or that these different things represent different notes. I don't entirely buy the things that I've seen, but it is something that's been tried. People have asked me what will happen if I'll be disappointed when Kryptos is solved, and my answer is God, no. I'd really like it off my plate at this point. I'm kind of tired of it, but I have thought about what. So people ask me also if I want to be the one to solve Kryptos Part 4, and I'm like, no, I just want to see it solved. I want it off my plate, so that's why I'm speaking on it, and I'll share information. I'll share all the information I've got. But I've also thought, you know, what would I work on after Kryptos? And the next code would probably be the Elgar cipher. I think it's the next one that's the most solvable, because I've heard that Elgar, he wrote other ciphers with that system, with those squiggle system. There's other notes that are in, like, Elgar museums here and there. And I haven't seen these notes. I don't know if these notes, I've never found these notes online, but that's what I would do, is I would track those down, and I would get all the information, and then I would make the Elgar, there is an Elgar discussion group, but I'd make a big Elgar website. But right now, it's in my copious free time. It's not one of the things that happens. Let me get him. Okay.
When talking to Sanborn, has he ever said, like, I'll release the answer on my deathbed at least?
Has Sanborn said that he would release the answer on his deathbed? No. He has actually said, there's a good story here, so let me figure out the right order to do it. He has said that He wants the sculpture to be unsolved when he dies, to which a few people have said, okay, we can arrange that now. In the encryption community, there's something called, there's a couple jokes. One is, when there's a new code that is created, there's a race to see if the brains can crack it before the spies can steal it. And then there's another thing called rubber hose cryptography, where you just beat the answer out of the person. But Sanborn has said that the answer, he has put the answer into two safe deposit boxes. One with family member, an extended family member, and also with his girlfriend, Jay Coe, who's an artist. And neither one of these people knows the answer, but they have access to the safe deposit box. And what they have is what's called the K4 test, Crypto's Part 4, the K4 test, where if someone were to go to them and say, I've solved Part 4, then Jay or whoever would say, okay, what is the 17th letter? And if someone answered correctly, then she'd say, okay, what is like the 35th letter? And if someone answered correctly to these tests, then she would go in and she would open the box to actually see the answer. And that's how she can test someone without actually, you know, being someone that releases it. Okay. Yes.
You mentioned a lot of the way he was writing was hiding shadows underground, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone checked to see if there's engravings on the bottom rim of Kryptos?
I don't think so. That's a good idea. I have a wish list on the web where there's various contractors that get access to grounds, and I say, if you're on grounds, check this, check this, check this. One guy, I asked him if he could check the width of the plate because we were trying to make a 3D model of the sculpture, and he didn't want anybody to see him measuring the width of the plate. So what he did is he took chewing gum and he took a little aluminum foil wrapper and he kind of went up and he put the wrapper up against the edge of the sculpture and then creased it and then put the wrapper back into his pocket, and then he went back to his office and he took out the wrapper and he measured it, and that's how he got the width of the sculpture, and he emailed that to us. No one's ever checked the lower rim. And at one point we were talking to Sanborn, and he said that there is a clue to Kryptos that is in plain sight that everyone has missed. So it's possible, like as I said, it's possible that one of the reasons it hasn't been solved is because there is something that's there. So I'll try to remember that about checking the rim, or send me an email, and I'll try and add it to my wish list. Or if there's anyone here who works at CIA, or knows someone who works at CIA, or is related to someone who works at CIA, pass it along. Okay.
We have an NSA representative.
Okay, I'll talk to them. Okay, let's get together and find out what her favorite alcohol is, and then we'll go from there. All right, question in the back.
Speaking about the plain sight clues, what parts of the courtyard were installed by Sanborn or by his design?
Okay.
The plate, or maybe a previous question, something you touched on previously, I apologize.
Let me see. The question is, which parts of the courtyard exactly were designed by Sanborn? And let me see if I can get this, and I can get that. Okay. So, here we have the cafeteria, the new headquarters building, and then this is the glass atrium. And Sanborn designed this entire green semicircle here. It's interesting from this view. You can actually see the shadows of the trees. We're not seeing the trees. We're seeing the shadows of the trees. And here, I don't know if you can see here, it looks like there's lampposts, but again, it's the shadows of the lampposts. And then there's a person, there's a truck. Kind of gives you an idea of scale. So Sanborn designed this entire green area here. There's a duck pond, two large stone slabs, and Kryptos. These little dots here are movable lunch tables. They can be dragged around, so the location of them doesn't mean anything. He also designed these slabs here, 1, 2, 3 slabs. These are on either side of the courtyard. So like this one right here, let's see, is that right there. And the compass rose is about here. And there's also a very, very small, I don't have a picture of it handy right here, but a very, very small unmarked slab right there, which is kind of in the shape of an arrowhead and may have something to do with it. It's possible that, because it's about at the right angle for where we think the latitude and longitude coordinates are, so maybe it's under there that we need to dig. We don't know. Who knows?
You you mentioned earlier about looking at this from a different perspective, and again, I haven't really met that familiar with it, but has anybody looked at, you know, the other three parts? He took one of the parts about the opening of King Tut's tomb and looking at similarities between the overlay of how, you know, not necessarily the expedition, but the tomb itself and the diagrams, and looking at, did he use any of that here? And also looking at, I mean, you talked to him, you know, he's obviously a very intelligent, very brilliant guy, very sure of himself, you know, looking at it from his psyche and the other three messages for other
Absolutely. The question was, Sanborn is a bright guy. He's been interested in a lot of different things, especially he was interested in this King Tut thing with Howard Carter. Have we looked at maybe looking for similarities between the opening of King Tut's tomb and looking at cryptos or other things from Sanborn's life? And the answer is yes, 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 and yes. John Wilson, who again is not here, he really dragged, I mean, he went through everything with a fine-tooth comb, everything to do with Howard Carter, King Tut's tomb, counting the number of the steps down to the tomb. John, if you go to his website, it's SciRealm, SciRealm, so members.aol.com/SciRealm. Or I link to it from my site as well, from Ilanka.com, and he really went into the Egyptology aspect to the point that was, and John, I've said this to John, but it was a little bit unhealthy. He was so far into it that if he moved letters around and he found like T-U-T next to each other, he was convinced that meant that he'd solved the code. And I'm like, no, you can, if you play Boggle, you can find three-letter words, pretty much as many three-letter words as you want. Oh, look, I found the word dig, D-I-G. And I'm like, John, no, that doesn't mean anything, John. But he kept going on and he kept finding these different words. And it was to the point that Sanborn finally wrote to John and said, John, this is not the way. So, and I've talked to Sanborn as well, and every so often Sanborn and I will kind of talk about the people who are not rowing with all oars, who work on cryptos. And I get letters probably about once a week from people who schizophrenics, mentally ill individuals. And in no way do I mean to make fun of them at all. Some of these people, I talked to a physician about why is it that some mentally ill people are so interested in these codes. And he said, well, his theory was, if you're talking about someone who's schizophrenic, it's not like someone is sane and then someone is schizophrenic. There's usually many different shades of gray in between the two. And as someone is going to what's called that psychotic break, where they're losing touch with reality, they go through this phase where you're struggling to see patterns, where like someone might look at a tree and like, was there someone in that tree? I'm not sure. I mean, there were branches. Maybe there was someone in that tree. And working on a code is often like that. You're looking at the letters and you're trying to find these patterns. And so it becomes very compelling to keep looking at the letters because you're sure that they're going to make sense soon. And there are some people I know who are on full disability. That's all they do is work on cryptos, full time.
Sort of like the movie A Beautiful Mind.
Exactly like, yeah, A Beautiful Mind, and where along with working on the codes, there are some other delusions that fit in as well. Beautiful Mind, by the way, Russell Crowe and Ron Howard, they did a really good job. When they had the scene where Russell Crowe was like looking at those just walls full of letters, and he was staring at it, and certain letters kind of rose up out of it. That's when I'm working on a code, that's exactly what it looks like to me. I'll be looking at a code and I'll tell my brain to look for such and such a pattern, and it'll look sort of like they rise up out of it. So when I saw them do that in the movie, I'm like, yeah, they got it right. But not the space aliens part. Okay, here.
Are there any magnetic elements to any of the stones or...
Okay, how many more questions can I do? This is the last question?
Yeah.
Okay. The question was whether or not there's any magnetic elements, and yes, there is a lodestone where the compass rose is. Let me see if I have a quick, really quick here. So here's the compass rose, and you can barely see it in this picture, but there's a stone. It's about this big, and it is a magnetic stone, and the compass needle is pointing towards that stone, and Sanborn has used these lodestones in other sculptures. There's probably three different compass rose sculptures around the D.C. area, and yes, we've plotted them out on a map to see where they're all pointing, to see if there's something intersecting. I've gone out and personally visited them and looked at the lodestones and pushed on them and done all that, but then again, maybe I missed something, so I don't know. Anyway, I could continue talking here for a couple hours, but we have another panel. Great questions. Thank you very much.